little different from last time. Okay, so we're talking about conformal field theory. And then you might have guessed that four lectures is not really good enough to cover conformal field theory. So I changed the title of the course again. I would say in four lectures, what we can do at the best is scratching the surface of the conformal field theory. But I meant literally. What do I actually do in 2D CFT? Well, for the rest of the lectures, today what I will live in somewhat higher dimensional creatures. Okay, so I think at this point of your life, you have been through so many weeks of QFT. You must know exactly how to do calculation. We write down an action, we calculate the tree level amplitude, the loop level, two loop, and go as many loops as you want. And maybe along the way, you throw a few infinities under the carpet. And see, now we're in this conformal field theory, so we should dress up formally. And then you would have, your shoes will have bootstraps that you can pull, and you can just make yourself fly, at least according to some Baron. But on the other hand, what I meant is there is this bootstrap hypothesis, which Hotet is going to tell us extensively. Where is Hotet? Yes, here. He's going to tell us extensively about it on Friday. And Pedro is a world expert on bootstrap hypothesis. And the hypothesis is conformal symmetry is so powerful, we should just be able to figure out all the correlations functions between all fields only based on symmetry consideration and the self-consistency. Hooray. Well, at the end of this series of lecture, we're only going to get a glance at how unitarity can tell us what kind of conformal field theories we can have. But just stay tuned for Hotet's talk. It's going to be awesome. All right. So I guess the first thing is always when you come to a course, especially it's optional, you should always ask why I'm here. I can try to give you some incentives to learn about CFT. So the first one is, so far, all the cute equations all respect to the conformal symmetry. And it's actually very cute because in cycle one, we learned relativity. And the first thing we look at in relativity is Maxwell equation. And this equation is obviously scale invariance, or vacuum Maxwell equation, since there were no scales. But it takes some more steps to prove it's actually conformally invariant, and there's some additional reading on the wiki that you can actually prove this thing, or the action of this thing is conformally invariant. So that's cycle one. Cycle two, in QFT one, we learned about massless Dirac field equation of motion looks like this. Since there's no mass, again, it's scale invariant. Still, stay in QFT1, and I'm sure you learned a lot about the lambda phi 4 theory. And if we also stay in d equals 4, and if we look at the equation of motion of it, it looks something like this. This equation of motion is also classically conformally invariant. I'll comment on the classically part just a bit. But as you say, this time we do have some lambda things. Okay. So then at the end, which happened the last week, I believe, we learned something called the Yang-Mills theory. And I hope you guys all remember the equation of motion for Yang-Mills theory, because some of the you guys will tell us about it next week in the interview. Okay. What do we mean by this big D? Yeah? How does it look like? if I want to read it out. Good. Some commentator. All right. Cool. I'll make an interview alert. I'm serious. Okay. So this is, again, classical lake. Okay, the reason that we mention it's a classically conformal invariant is quantum mechanically they will get corrected because these are these unfortunately named objects called coupling constant, but they're not constant. In the week before that week, we learned a power technique, or some of you guys might call it the dark magic of renormalization group, says that they all actually secretly depend on scale. And you can actually calculate how they run by calculating the beta function defined to be some derivatives of scale. And in general, it doesn't vanish. So if you go quantum mechanically, they start running, then it's not conformal invariant anymore. OK, at this point, you're like, OK, we're not living in a conformal invariant world. By the demonstration, I can't just talk forever and ignore the time that has been passing by. So let me try to give you more argument about why should we care about conformal field theory. So let's consider there is, let's call it the QFT space. I can only draw three dimensions, but of course it has many, 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 many dimensions, probably infinite many. But let's say there is a QFT space and you move in this space when you change all the sum of this coupling. And what we try to claim is CFT is crucial in QFT space. It's so crucial in the sense that we consider QFTs are just deformations. Of CFTs by relevant operators. Oh, by the way, you should be really, really know about the relevant operators because that's also your interview question next week. Okay. So, okay, let me elaborate on this. But let's think about it. It's actually really remarkable we can do physics at all. Like a QFT is really remarkable. As Dan will soon tell you that we can calculate something to the 12th digit and compare to the experiment, and they agree perfectly. But this is really remarkable. Because think about it. We went to this PID about quantum gravity, which basically tells us that at some high scale, say Planck scale, what do we know? Well, we know close to nothing. And then we go to LHC somewhere down here with orders of magnitude between, still knowing nothing. But in the LHC, people start to calculate cross-sections and compare to the experiment, and they all agree. And then down there, there's some condensed matter experiments that you agree even better. How is this possible? We know absolutely nothing at some scale, and then we're going down, and we start knowing things. So this is what Wilson renormalization group tells us. It basically hands us a recipe for successful effective field theories. So far, we just have a lot of effective field theories. They work extremely well, but only to a certain point. And some theories claim that they work for everything, but I think a lot of people has comments on that. All right, the recipe is, first, let's think about what kind of degrees of freedom you want to have and what kind of symmetry you want to have. So you probably have let's consider a simple case. I have a scalar field, and somehow I demand that it has mirror symmetry. If I change phi to minus phi, nothing changes. So step one. Step two, you literally write down everything. So you write down the connector, and then you write down the infinite many operators with some coefficient. It's really infinite many, and the law is really anything that can happen, should happen. Okay. So then you do some dimensional analysis. And they realize, hopefully realize, that only finite of them are relevant.
Well,
relevant means I are relevant. And then you get very happy. So as long as they stay very, very low scale, then everything drops off except a few terms. And you can happily says, let's pick an experiment energy scale compared to experiment to fix some of these GIs that are still relevant. Now everything else, you just use RJ flow to flow them. And then you compare to experiment again and realize it's still agree with the experiment. Marvelous, we did physics. So this miracle is probably known by you guys very well, and by me very little. It's known as the universalities. Is that objects arranged from very different microphysics, such as water in the phase transition and magnets something, and they somehow have the same behavior, like in terms of critical exponents. Okay, so, and they were like, where does CFT comes in? Well, CFT comes in, CFT is precisely where all the beta function, let's say beta I, of in principle depends on all the other coupling constants that are interesting. They all of them vanish, is what we call a CFT. Because the beta function is really the energy or scale dependence of the coupling constant. If the beta function vanishes, that means it doesn't depend on the scale. So by definition, this thing is scale invariant. You're like, there are still a few steps between scale invariant and conformal invariant. Yeah, but with reasonable assumptions, such as unitarity or relativity, and relativity. And then you find that scale invariance almost implies conformal invariance. I say almost because nobody proved it. But Joy might believe this. Hey, he wants to bet with other people that this is indeed true. And there are a lot of people trying to find the theory that are scale invariant, unitarity, and relativistics, but not a conformal invariant, and it has failed so far. So we can just sort of at this point, I'll just believe that in this QFT space, there is this fixed point, there's where CFT lies. And if you take some relevant operator, it will take you away from CFT. Along the way, you probably discover the more realistic QFTs that you can predict and compare with experiments. And this irrelevant operator just take you back to the CFT. And if you have lots of CFT, maybe they will take you to a different CFT next time. So it's really CFT, all these dots, it's like the stars that are holding all the QFT space together. Okay, so this is my second motivation. And for the third, well, so mandula. Yes.
Is such kind of CFT always exist for any kind of action?
Well, you can always drop out the coupling, and then the free action is always. There is always the Gaussian fixed point. Because you just take away all the interaction, the free action is always CFT. But there exist. There exists such a fixed point called the Wilson-Fisher fixed points that are not trivial. Like there could be CFTs that do have coupling constant, and still they are CFTs. And then and the 2D is where that there are so many CFTs that it's extremely rich. You have a landscape of CFTs. And you can even flow in a direction. There's some other direction called the marginal direction. And along this line, everything is CFT. Okay. But Let's come back to my third motivator. What's my third motivator? Okay, it's proven that this conformal symmetry is the maximum symmetry of a relativistic QRT. Okay, I should put a star on the maximum, and it means not considering supersymmetry. If you consider a supersymmetry, then the superconformal symmetry is the maximum symmetry. And come on, we always like to start in maximum symmetric things, right? It's like, and we always like to study a spherical in a vacuum, maximally symmetric. It's easy to study. Yes?
Why don't topological theories fall on this? Like, wouldn't those be easier than conformal theories?
Topological theories are. Topological field theories are easier.
Yeah.
Hmm. Teach me about it.
No, well, you would assume that they would have more symmetry because, you know, there's just less to talk about.
Right? The point is that in this symmetry, we have so much symmetry that it constrains everything, as we will learn tomorrow and learn extensively tomorrow in the so-called monster tutorial one, that it constrained our correlation function so much there is nothing to calculate. You just write down the answer. Okay. The last motivation is that, well, we know almost nothing about quantum gravity, but there is this ADS-CFT correspondence. It seems that quantum gravity can be defined by the CFT theories living on the boundary. It's in ADS, for unfortunately, but we take what we have. All right, so that's my explanation why we should learn about CFT. And the next question, of course, is what is CFT that I have been talking about for 20 minutes? This is actually the course outline. What is CFT? Because in today's class, we're going to ask about the first letter, what is conformal? And the second lecture, we're going to ask what a field. And of course, in the third and last lecture, we'll ask what a theory is. So today, we're going to talk about what do you mean by conformal symmetry. And that might, hopefully, remind you a certain front-end course you took, that whenever you have a symmetry, you have a group, you study the algebra, and then you build the Hilbert space and with that. Okay. And then tomorrow, we'll basically do the same thing, hopefully quicker, in 2D, and then introduce some major players in town, known as the primary fields and the energy momentum tensor fields. And in the last two lectures, we're trying to find the algebra again, whether it's the 2D algebra, which is much enriched because we're living in a plane. And then we'll find the quantum corrected algebra and build a Hilbert space. And then we ask the questions, what self-consistency, such as if you require unitarity, what kind of conformal field theory can we have? So this is literally the course outline. We spend the whole lecture trying to answer what is CFT. So what's today's outline? Well, first we ask, what do you mean by conformal transformations besides the ones that we mentioned a lot called the scaling? And then it's a symmetry, so let's study the algebra. And then at the very end, we'll take a sneak peek, which makes us peeking ducks, at the ADS CFT correspondence. It's really, really a peeking. And if you want to learn more, Pedro will teach you all about it in the string theory exploration. So, and let's start the official part, the methy part of the lecture. So what are conformal transformations? That brings us to when we met at the very beginning. We learned something called the Poincaré transformation, Poincaré group. And later on in relativity, we learned this is the maximum isometry in Minkowski space, i.e. the data-preserved metric. So let me remind you that this Poincaré transformation is X mu with Lorentz plus some translation. And this transformation is particularly nice in the sense that it preserves the metric, or we can say it preserves the distance and the angle. So this is just another way to write what's a Poincaré transformation. Poincaré transformation is anything that satisfies this guy. Okay, but we want to abandon the distance. The idea of dense distance we don't want, because we want our theory to be scale invariant. So okay, we don't care about distances. We can change the distance. The only thing we care is angles. So we're going to modify this to say that your distance can change by something called a conformal factor. And if you calculate the angle between two vectors, these conformal factors will nicely drop out, so it'll still preserve the angle. Okay, so conformal transformation, you can take this as the definition. Is it satisfy this equation that measures the distance and distance changed? Okay, let me try to do some drawing to explain what I meant. So suppose I start, this is a unit circle, and I start with 2 points, x and y. So the left-hand side says, let me consider this conformal transformation as a transformation on the coordinates. So in the new coordinates, I'll draw inversion as an example, because inversion is a popular conformal transformation. Then the x and the y move to x tilde and y tilde. Then we still measure it by eta. So the point has been moved, but we use our Minkowski metric to measure. And of course, we expect the distance changes as what we wanted. We want the conformal transformation to change the distance. On the other hand, you can consider this transformation as x and y didn't move. What we did is we changed the metric. Instead of using eta to measure, we use this conformally flat metric to measure the distance. And those should be equivalent descriptions. Okay? All right. So let's look at some very famous and non-trivial conformal transformations. So here's the example. Okay, the Poincaré transformation just take omega x equals 1, so it's definitely a conformal transformation. So we can look at our favorite thing says scale. If I scale my coordinate by lambda, and you can just plug it that in, and you get omega x, this conformal factor is lambda, okay, with some absolute value and stuff. Right? It makes sense. It says if you scale your coordinate to be lambda bigger than your conformal factor, your distance becomes lambda bigger. Yeah, that one is defined with a square for some reason. Okay. Then the next thing we want to look at is the inversion. And if you work on it and try to calculate the differential of x tilde and then dot them together, dot with eta, and you can see omega x equals 1 over x squared. Okay.
Yes. In the inverted example, like in the second figure, is the x and y is not inside the circle?
No, it's not moved at all. So that's just another point of view of conformal transformation. You can consider conformal transformation is equivalent to do a well transformation of the metric and do not move the point at all. So there's two points of view. The first point says we move the points, but we use the same metric. That's why the distance change. The other point of view says, well, the points are not moved, but you are marrying with a different metric, such that the idea is that you always change the distance. And those two points of view should be the same. It says that if you move the point, then the distance should be changed by that factor. And you can say that it works with the scaling example, because you have dx tilde, dx give you a factor of lambda, it give you two factor of lambda, and then there is this omega square, so omega is lambda. Yep.
In GR, if you have this kind of transformation, and this transformation neither kills or creates a singularity, you know that because it's GR, you can always transform back to some system where you're singularity free. But in this case, you actually create physical singularities, right?
But you're still...
Because, like, you divide by x squared, and you don't have diffeomorphism.
Yeah, then you will add this like point at the infinity to make it... it's like you can add a point to a complex plane, make it a Riemann sphere. And you can add a infinity light cone to make it nice, if it's Lorentz.
Okay.
But we're still in flat space. We're not talking about it. In the other point of view, the metric has changed.
Yeah.
But you can always consider we always leave on the flat space. The only thing we're doing is coordinate transformation. And we still use the flat metric mirror. Okay, so... then now we can write down the conformal condition. What I'm going to do is just divide the differential over, so we get a partial x mu, partial x alpha, partial x beta. And with this conformal factor. Now there's nothing fancy. I differentiate to the differentials over, and this is what is known as the conformal condition, and says, ha, if I'm able to solve this, I'm done. If I can now find all the x tildes as the generalization of this, and I found all the conformal transformations that ever existed. So what's the next step? How do you propose to solve for x tilde? This time you must be expert on it. And whenever you don't know what to do, then you look at the vicinity of identity, and hopefully we can do expansion, do things, and hopefully you can integrate them back and find the finite conformal transformation as well. Okay, sorry. But let's expand this to be some x plus some epsilon mu, which is a function of x, and who knows what it is, but hopefully it's small. Then we're going to consider this thing small and expand this. Any questions?
What we're
doing is trying to solve what the x tilde. So for Poincaré group, it's very clear what is x tilde. X tilde is described by four translation and six rotations. And I wanted the full form for conformal field theory. So as if we have conformal symmetry, what is epsilon? What can I do? Okay. It's clear that why we're doing this. And it should be also clear how we do this, because we do this many times in relativity. I personally know it. All right, so left hand side, I'll just write down the solution, because you really should have done this multiple times. And if you haven't, and you look at the result, then you still should feel that you have done it multiple times. So you just plug this in, drop all the epsilon squared, this should be what you have. And you really should have done it at least twice, maybe three times, if you ask this question in the interview. All right. So first we recognize, suppose we have Poincaré transformation, we just get rid of this, and the etas cancel, of course, that's the zeros order, and this is zero for our Poincaré. And this is known as the Killing equation. You recognize it, right? Okay. And now let's suppose that we really want to study conformal transformations. So we have this thing, but now it equals whatever this is, we're going to figure out. But it's some factor. It's just a linear expansion of that. You can call it 2 omega if you want, or whatever. With omega squared minus 1. Okay. But this is not hard to figure out. We just take the trace. We get 2 partial dot epsilon equals d times this whatever it is. And then this thing, you just divide the d over. So our conformal Killing equation says it's that Q to form. And on the right-hand side, you have something. And this something is given by this. Okay. So this is known as the conform Killing equation. So our focus is trying to solve for this epsilon. Yes?
How did you get the second line, like 2 over d times something?
Just trace. So you take the trace, you get a 2 times this. This you only trace the eta, you get a d, and then you divide the d over.
Is something like
this is the something.
D dot e is shorthand notation for.
Right. Okay. Let me write it up. It's defined to be whenever I write a dot, this is always what I meant. I mean, at some point I'll definitely miss some indices. So this is just making me miss less of them, fewer of them. Okay. So now our focus is solve for the epsilons. And I'll be doing very fishy argument that says that will get us all the conformal transformation. But it's still, we're still doing the same thing. Our goal is to ask what kind of transformations are conformal transformations. And this is the equation for the infinitesimal transformations. So how do we propose to solve this? Okay. The trick is doing a bunch more derivatives. So let's get rid of some index by, let's call this star, acting partial nu on star. So then the first term gave me this partial dot epsilon again. And this one gave me box epsilon nu. And on the other side, you just get to this partial nu. It become a mu. Okay. And then you do partial mu. Let's call this equation star square. Again. So you get a box partial dot epsilon plus box partial epsilon. Da da da, box partial epsilon. Okay, do over d. So basically, you just went to box dot partial epsilons. So this thing must be 0. And you can consider this is really saying if you add 3 derivatives on epsilon, you get a 0, which means epsilon is at most quadratic. So I can really write out epsilon mu as some constant some linear term and some quadratic term. Okay. And then, of course, you wonder, is that all we can do? Fortunately, it is. Like, we can do something better than this, because that's still a huge number of parameters. Just think about how many. Something has 3 indices. Even if 2 of them are symmetric, it's still lots of parameters. But guess what I'm erasing? Is it clear how I get the epsilon is up to quadratic? Yes?
Do we have to have that? Are there not more generous solutions?
what multiple general solution? I claim that's the most general solution. Well, I claim that's more than most general solution. We're trying to find what is the solution. So this should, if anything is a solution, it has the infinitesimal form, should be encoded there. But we do have something more to say about these coefficients such that the solution is slightly prettier than that, or we reduce the number of parameters. Yes?
Yeah, but usually, always when you have an equation box of something equals to zero, there is like a...
Yeah, wave solution, but we're doing infinitesimal expansion.
Right, so basically what you're saying is you might have wave solutions, but like if you expand things, you only care about second order.
Yeah, well, we're really saying that we're doing a Taylor expansion, and if that's the case, we only care up to second order. Yes?
Do you know there are not quantum transformations that can't be about the identity?
1 over x?
Right, so but you won't get that response.
We will.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we will. That's the beauty of this. That's why I'm confidently tell us we are actually going to do a perturbation today. Because we will get it. Okay. So let's now make, well, it's actually maybe look uglier, but we will definitely get rid of many of the parameters. So first of all, the first term a mu, I mean, without really solving anything, I mean, it's clear that's a translation. And it's clearly working. If you just plug this into only derivatives, of course, you get a bunch of zeros, and then they are equal. So the only care is by the next term, which is linear in x. And if I plug this in my beautiful equation,
They are all constants.
Because you're Taylor expanding.
Yeah, I'm confused because like you wrote like
the
d dot epsilon is the what is it like d mu epsilon mu, right?
Yep.
So if we differentiate those epsilon mu, like it automatically gives zero, isn't it?
Huh?
I mean, if we differentiate like
with partial? Yeah. Why?
Like the index. Like differentiation with.
So yeah, yes, the first one automatically give you zero, but the next one should give you delta mu nu, right?
Perfect.
Well, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's actually what we're gonna do. We're gonna do the differentiation with these things. Okay, so this is not the hardest differentiation ever. It's linear in x, and we're doing one derivative. So I'm going to write down the answer. So this one gives you C mu nu, this is C nu mu, and this is 2 over D, and you get the trace. And I'm lost to the eta again, but let's keep it. So what is this telling me? This is telling me that the symmetric part of this C mu nu gives me a trace. The symmetric part of this guy is one constant, because you trace over the index, times eta mu nu. Now there is an anti-symmetric part of this thing. Who knows what do I do with it? So the solution is the trace times eta mu nu plus something that's anti-symmetric that I have no idea what they are. But indeed, the conformal Kaelin equation does give you a constraint on this C mu nu. Before they seems to be D by D matrices. But now it says no. There's no, the symmetric part only has a trace left. And all that remains is the anti-symmetric part. That's clear? Okay. And what are the anti-symmetric part? They are the Lorentz rotations, right? So we already get to the translations. Now we get the rotations. And this is the extra piece. But this extra piece, it's saying I'm changing x mu to x mu plus constant times x mu. So of course, this is what we call the scale transformation, which we want. OK, one more term.
How can we know omega mu nu is responsible for the rotation?
Oh, that's just what we did. If you expand the lambda, the Lorentz matrix, you expand it with identity, and you can prove that that one is Sanderson. If you want a reminder, you can go back to look at linear algebra tutorial 1. That's where we figured that out.
So that omega is different from the generator of the full Lorentz group, like you only describe the rotation.
No, no, no. But by rotations, I meant the SO31 rotation.
Okay, so you include boost.
So yeah, the rotations plus boost, whatever. It's really the rotations in the whole space. So basically, we already got a Poincaré. Poincaré is translation plus rotations, and we already got an extra piece by doing some linear differentiation. Not bad. I would see. Okay. Now I will actually not carry you through this quadratic derivation. It's slightly lengthy, and I don't feel like it's entirely illuminating, which involving manipulate this conformal Killing equation many some more times and find more identities like this thing, but something else. It says plug in the third term in there and do some more things, find more equations and do things. And eventually I'll just write you the result. And I really don't, but anyway, like it's derived at the appendix of the lecture notes. So you can just check. Or you can just do it yourself. Do it as an exciting exercise. But the result is says that we thought that we have some three indices object with some symmetric properties, but in the end, no, everything else disappeared due to this conformal equation. What we cared is some one index object. So there are many parameters encoded in E, but in the end, there are only D of them matters.
So what does it say? I cannot really read it. D mu is equal to 1 over
D. It's defined to be some 1 over D times E with two index traced.
Okay.
I don't know how to write it better. It's really traced over some index and a carrier index.
Okay.
All right. It just says that if you manipulate this conformal Killing equations long enough, you will realize that the parameter, we don't have that many parameters. What are the parameters remain is this guy. Well, I mean, it's sort of believable. We say before we have a no constrained matrix, we managed to get rid of the symmetric part because of the conformal Killing equation. So since we have this powerful equation, it's possible that we can get rid of many parameters. And this is what it is. Now, even the answer was not super enlightening. But okay, let me try to enlighten you a little bit, since people probably wouldn't like me if I say, oh, this is the final result. Okay, but let's summarize. What do we got here? It's translation, which is clear how that A mu is promoted to a finite translation. I'm even still going to call it A mu. So now I have already promoted the translation to a finite version. It's kind of like exponential it, but you still get the translation anyway. And there is the rotations. And as I just mentioned, we have seen before how to promote that omega into our Lorentz matrices. And it's also very clear how to promote that scale. You just write it as some scale. And what the hell is that thing? Well, it's known as the special conformal transformations because we are out of names. And then it's also by some way of exponentiating, which I wouldn't try to demonstrate. It's probably buried in some references. But this special conformal transformation says this thing is the exponential form of that guy. And which again, I use some notations as if I say x dot x, I'll just write x squared. And this is still not in particular illuminating, but you can definitely check, just expand it by b, you will get this as the infinitesimal transformation. The other direction is much harder. Okay, you're like, huh, what am I supposed to take away with this? You can't even remember it. No, I can't. But if you calculate something like x tilde square, which is defined by x tilde dot x tilde, and then you can realize this transformation satisfies a very cute equation, which you see I can remember. And you can see, we got an inversion anyway. It says, let me draw the unit circle again. Suppose I have x over here. I can do an inversion to get this thing. It's sloppily written as S inverse. And then I translate it to some here. Let's call this step subtracting b nu, very sloppily. But then I do another inversion. I get x tilde. So, special conformal transformation, although the formula is not very enlightening, but it really says it's an inversion followed by a translation followed by another inversion. So we got the inversion.
Sorry, could you please explain the diagram again? Like, I can't really follow it.
So this says we do an inversion.
Yeah.
So I invert it. Okay. Maybe you can't follow it because I didn't draw it on a straight line, but let's say this is the unit circle, and I invert it, and I should get somewhere here. And then I translate. Translation just means moving a straight line. And this vector, let's call it a b. And I got this point. And then it says the special conformal transformation will transform x to x tilde, where the x tilde is exactly the inversion of this guy. So you do an inversion, move it, and if you invert it again, it will give you x tilde. So this thing is the inversion of x, and the inversion of x tilde is different by a constant vector characterized by that bin mu thing, right? So this, you can even call this inversion of x mu, and this is the inversion of x tilde mu. And what special conformal transformation says is that it's transformed to somewhere such that the inversion of the original point and the new point is different by a constant vector. And that a constant vector is the vector characterize your special conformal transformation. Question?
But then it means that you don't get the inversion transformation, right? Because your only parameter is b. Set b to 0, you're just saying the point stays where it was.
Yeah, but you did get an inversion. The inversion popped out somewhere. So the inversion is somehow captured. It can't be captured by some specific b because inversion cannot write in this infinitesimal form, right? But what we are saying is that if you exponentiate it, find the finite version of this special conformal transformation, you need to get an inversion there. And you have this cute way of understanding what do we mean by special conformal transformation. It's the inversion followed by translation followed by another inversion. Okay, so now we finish. The first thing we want to do is find all the conformal transformations. And we need. They are there. Okay, so let me just remind you, we have a translation, a Lorentz thing, and we have a scale, and we have this special conformal transformation parameter b mu. These are all the parameters we found. And that's it. Okay, so let's move to the second part of today's lecture, is trying to find the algebra. I remember your first Lie algebra tutorial? It's that kind of thing. Okay, so first, in order to find the algebra, we know how to do. We find the generators, and then we find all the commutator with them. Okay, so let's do something. Let's simplify our life by consider a scalar field, so it has no Lorentz properties. And also, we want this field to have scaling dimension zero. So this field itself doesn't transform. But you know, the field only transforms because of the conformal transformation. So what I want to claim is f tilde at x tilde equals fx. We'll take some special scalar field that has this nice property to find out what are the generator of the conformal transformation. So if you take something else, you will get the other generator, like Lorentz generators pop out as well. That just makes our life even harder. It's not an easy life as it is. So let's just say, let's consider a very nice field such that this is true. The new phi at x tilde should be equals to the old phi at x. Okay,
so yep. Explicitly, do you have an example, like something which has, because it's going to have the scale factor inside phi, right?
Yeah.
So that when you scale x, like it's going to divide by the same thing or something.
Well, if your dimension is zero, like if you consider massless, if you consider free scalars in two-dimensional, then all your dimension from the action is given by the partial derivatives. And that is a specific case, phi has no scaling. So if you consider 2D, which actually you will study so extensively in the second tutorial. So if you consider this guy, this gives you the two scaling you need. Phi is scaling dimension zero. So there are cases such things exist. But let's just hypothetically, this is such a thing, such that all the transformation in the phi, by that I meant delta phi, x is defined to be phi tilde at x minus phi at x. So this is not zero because you change the location. And there is going to be a change. And that change will be characterized by the generator of the conformal transformation, which we actually define that to be minus I. Don't worry about the I's. They just make eventually the result agree with something we know. And that's just the definition. The generators is defined to be what changed in phi at the same location. Yeah?
I cannot actually read the...
Sorry?
Like minus I, omega I.
Omega is just...
Sorry.
So this just says all those parameters. It's any of them. That's just the infinitesimal parameter. And the G is the generator. So it says the infinitesimal parameter times the generator acting phi should be equals to the change. And you can even exponentially say something like this. And this A is just, I don't know, it runs through all of them. And omega is some name for all of them, running out of name.
The infinitesimal.
Okay, maybe I should just use epsilon. But these are constants. So I'll use the curly epsilon to denote any of the infinitesimal parameters. And you can even exponentially then get the group, get the finite transformation of the field. We don't worry about this minus I too much. It's just a convention. I mean, this is always true. You can parameterize the change of the field by some infinitesimal parameters linearly. OK, but let's actually calculate what is it. So we have phi x by the by the choice is equals to phi tilde at x tilde. Just make our life easier. And then, of course, I can expand this. And I didn't write the expansion. So I'm going to write the expansion as x tilde is equals x mu plus some infinitesimal parameter and times something. I mean, I can always define this thing. So this thing is defined to be the change in x divided by this linear parameter. So this is always possible. Don't worry about if it looks like functional derivative, but it literally means this thing is defined in this way. For any infinitesimal transformation, I can always define this thing. And we'll see an example. But let's say that's true. Sorry, I'm going to write the other way. So then it's x tilde minus this thing. And now I can do expansions at f phi at x tilde minus this thing times partial mu phi. So that's just Taylor expansion. And now I can compare this guy and that guy. And they indeed, they are at the same location. So by definition, this part is the change of phi under such an infinitesimal transformation. So this should be equals to the other definition. So I can read off JA acting on phi should equals to this delta x mu delta epsilon a partial nu act on phi times I. But I is actually important. Okay. So basically, it's just a recipe says, how do I find all the JAs? Here is the recipe. You find this thing, and times partial mu is JA. Okay, let's do a example. For example, if I look at scaling, which is x mu tilde equals x mu plus some alpha x mu. And by definition, if I compare that with the definition of that thing, and I change this to be alpha, this thing is x mu. Right? I'm just comparing this line and the definition of that object. And that object, I can just read it off as x mu. And then I claim that the generator corresponding to the scaling, which is often known as the dilatation, is given by minus I x mu partial mu. So this is a weird notation. You can just call something with the upper index mu downstairs index A. It literally says, write down the infinitesimal transformation, compare with that guy, and whatever is linear in your infinitesimal parameter, then you call this object. And the idea of define that thing is that if you define that, then you immediately can read off what's the generator. Okay? We can do another example. See, we have so this is scaling. We can also look at translation equals x mu plus a mu. And now we can also look at this object. I'll call it a nu. But this time, It's basically delta. Right? I can always write this as A nu times delta mu nu. And now I can compare these two lines and find out this object is this thing. And then that tells us my generator for the translation is given by minus I partial mu. Well, that's good, because this is what you are familiar with, which is the momentum. And of course, you can do this with the omega mu nu, which is the Lorentz transformation. Then there is this B nu. You can get the other generators. And because this omega mu nu is anti-symmetric and the other one is slightly complicated, they take more than one line to figure out what's the generator. But it's just math. And you will get some results. And I can't remember them, so it's somewhere hidden here, if I can find them. But it's the same stuff. You can, I mean, I have derived in the lecture notes, so you can just read about them. But if you do them all, you will find this is indeed as expected. This is the angular momentum. This we have derived. One is dilatation. One is momentum. Now this is the special conformal generator. I mean, the transformation doesn't look that pretty, so the generator can't look that pretty either. And then you can just do all the commutators. But remember when I gave you the first tutorial of Lie algebra, I said that's a once-a-lifetime thing. So you don't have to do it again. So that's the result. Well, at least you know the last two lines, because if you finish that tutorial, that's what the tutorial about, is arriving at the last two lines. And then there is all the other lines. I checked them, and it's also at the appendix of the tutorial, at the lecture notes. It's not entirely illuminating. It's just changing a bunch of partial derivatives, and eventually you'll get this. Okay. So that's the second thing we do, is we look at this algebra. Okay, let's try to be more illuminating than this six-line, many, many generators algebra. And I do the following things. Counting. So we did a lot of algebra today. Let's do arithmetic. I like it. So let's say how many generators we have. We have D from the translation. I hear something. D times D minus 1 over 2 from the Lorentz. 1 from the dilatation. D again from a special conformal transformation. Can somebody tell me what does that add up to? Come on, just do it. I will give you 1 minute to do this addition. Can't be that hard.
D plus 1, D plus 2.
Thank you. I'll claim this is the most important result of today, such that I'll put it in a box. And also, whenever I, like, for each lecture, I'll try to find one thing you want to take away from the lecture. If you forget everything else, and the one thing you should remember, and if that happens, I'll give you a red sign. But anyway, this is really the one thing you should take away from this lecture, is this arithmetic. Because the left-hand side is the conformal field theory in D dimension. Has this many generators. And then on the other hand, can somebody say, tell me what group this corresponding to? The something times something minus 1 over 2. So this must be the number of generators of? What?
SOD
comma 2. Very good. You even figure out the signature, which I can't figure out from just looking at this. But awesome. And the point is, SOD comma 2 happens to be the isometric group of ADS in D plus 1 dimension. So at least at the zeros level, that we suspect there could be a correspondence, because at least the symmetry group agrees. Well, OK. If I just count some generators and claim they are the same symmetry group, you're like, oh, come on. It's two numbers, 5 equals 5, and you already make bold claim like this. Oh, by the way, this one, you can say it has SOD comma 2 because you can embed ADS D plus 1 as a sort of a sphere thing, a hyperspace thing in the D plus 2 with signature 2D. Anyway, so the last thing we want to do is to make this baby correspondence a little bit more precise by doing some redefinition. But basically what this argument is trying to tell us to do is that we have L mu here, which is the D times D minus 1 over 2 thing. And there is something like a D. There's two things that has D of them. It's like, I'll write them in the middle, because what actually happened is we need the linear combination, but at least the number was right. And here, we want the off-diagonal to be the dilatation. At least it fits in this picture. But then if you are more rigorous, you can do the following redefinition. Literally take some linear combination of those two things. Not the hardest linear combination either. And you call the off-diagonal term dilatation. And then you wonder, what's the commutator of J? I'm not going to rewrite it. But the commutator of the J is literally this line, replace all the L by J's. So it's literally the Lorentz algebra. And with eta, the 2 comma D signature, and with the indexes running through minus 2 to D minus 1. So not only just they agree in terms of number of the generators, they are literally the same algebra. And you can even say that if you have any RPQ space plus conformal transformation, and that will promote your symmetry group to be P plus 1, Q plus 1. Okay. So that's the end of today's lecture. And tomorrow we're going to do everything in 2D. And then start trying to see how we can abandon the action and find something that we can write down, this, for example, the correlation functions without ever writing down the action, and to see how powerful this symmetry is. And then it becomes way more powerful in 2D. It's actually infinitely more powerful, literally infinitely more powerful, because we'll find that our algebra is infinitely dimensional. But anyway. See you tomorrow.
Can you explain again what you mean by this matrix notation? Like, what is where? Do we understand?
What?
Where is the PVU and the KVU in that matrix?
Okay, here I am. It's really that thing. It's the linear combination. So you can put all your generators together, such that it fits nicely in this picture, satisfying the anti-symmetric problem. And then it's really just a picture of what we're doing here. And this is the rho minus 2 mu, and this is rho minus 1 mu, and this is that one. By the way, I need to alert you about a Monsters tutorial tomorrow. I'm sorry. It's an optional course. I just can't help but write longer and longer. No, like, my complex solutions, and there is no interview on them. You have no homework, and if you don't want to do it, you can just read through the solutions. But do you prefer me to split it into two slightly less monstrous tutorial, and then have tutorial on Wednesday? I just give you everything on Tuesday. I'll come in on Wednesday if you have questions. I prefer I just give you everything, and I'll show up on Wednesday too. But it's not short. I'm going to be very conservative, since I'm apparently competing with my husband. But I'm not. I'm not in a competition.